early birds, you've caught The Worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio, rounding up stories from our newsroom and Montana Public Radio. I'm Nikki Ouellette, filling in for Jess Sheldahl. Today is Friday, February 7th. Today we've got stories on the state's largest utilities plan to buy more into the Colstrip coal-fired power plant, how this winter's wacky weather is leading to both wildland fires and above-average snowpack, and why Butte public health officials are unwrapping dirty diapers. The state's largest utility filed its intent to purchase an added share of the Colstrip coal-fired power plant in eastern Montana on Wednesday. Kayla DeRoche with Yellowstone Public Radio News has more.
Northwestern Energy filed paperwork with the Montana Public Service Commission asking for approval to buy an added 25% share of Colstrip Unit 4 from Puget Sound Energy for $1. The purchase would add around 185 megawatts to the utility's portfolio. According to the filing, Northwestern has the intention of selling about 90 megawatts of that back to Puget Sound for around 5 years. Northwestern Energy first announced its intentions in December and has since been publicly advocating for the purchase. Northwestern Energy Vice President of Energy Supply, John Hines, spoke about the intended purchase at an Economic Outlook seminar in Billings this week. He said the power market is no longer as robust as it once was.
There's a shrinking amount of power that we can actually go out and buy, especially the unique type of power that Colstrip provides. And that's the type that you can count on when it's really cold out, when it's dark out.
Earlier this year, Colstrip Units 1 and 2 went offline. And as Washington-based utilities pull out of the power plant financially, Northwestern is looking to increase its investment. The utility has said it relies too much on purchasing energy from the open market and needs to add about 200 megawatts of capacity annually, with a goal of 725 extra megawatts by 2025. Meanwhile, environmental groups like the Sierra Club and the Montana Environmental Information Center are already pushing back against the purchase. Ann Hedges with the Montana Environmental Information Center says Northwestern is hiding the true costs that come with the purchase.
Northwestern keeps talking about, you know, it's only going to be a dollar, but that's not what it costs to operate the plant day in and day out. Those costs will have to be borne by their customers, and those are the costs that we want to know about.
The PSC has 7 to 9 months from the date of filing to make a decision. The commission will conduct public comment throughout that process. The proposed purchase is part of a larger business deal that would include buying a share of Puget Sound's transmission system. Kayla DeRoche, Yellowstone Public Radio News.
An infectious disease lab in western Montana is joining the worldwide effort to study a coronavirus that originated in China, has infected over 28,000 people, and killed more than 560. Rocky Mountain Laboratories in Hamilton received its first sample of the 2019 novel coronavirus on Wednesday. Emmy DeWitt, the lab's principal investigator on the new virus, says researchers have already started projects and more will get underway soon. The topics include how long the virus might remain infectious on a surface and how it binds to cells. They will also test the safety of vaccines and other treatments. More than 85% of the money fueling primary campaigns for Montana's U.S. House race this year is held by just two candidates, Republican Matt Rosendale and Democrat Kathleen Williams. Montana Public Radio's Corin Cates-Carney reports.
Rosendale and Williams each have more than $800,000 in the bank to start off the 2020 election year. The latest federal race fundraising reports show Williams' campaign coffers are more than 7 times that of her only primary opponent, Missoula House Representative Tom Winter. Williams, a former state lawmaker from Bozeman, also has more money coming into her campaign from within Montana than any other candidate in the race. Current Republican State Auditor Matt Rosendale is leading the 5-way GOP primary with more than 13 times more cash on hand than Secretary of State Corey Stapleton, who has the second largest bank account. Montana's current U.S. Congressman Greg Gianforte is not seeking re-election and instead is running for governor. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, more than $13 million bankrolled the race for the last Montana U.S. House election in 2018. I'm Corin Cates-Carney, Montana Public Radio News.
The American Civil Liberties Union of Montana yesterday filed a lawsuit with the goal of learning how the state may respond to expected protests against the construction of the Keystone XL oil pipeline. Kayla DeRoche has more.
In its complaint, the ACLU says it requested documents from Montana Disaster and Emergency Services and the Montana Division of Criminal Investigation based on its concern that the agencies are preparing to impede First Amendment freedoms like free speech and assembly in a coordinated crackdown with local, state, and federal law enforcement. The complaint was filed in Lewis and Clark County District Court Thursday. ACLU attorney Lillian Alvarez says in early 2018, the ACLU filed a public records request about government preparation for potential protests against the Keystone XL pipeline, but she says the agencies are improperly withholding the documents.
And the documents that they did produce are so heavily redacted, it is hard to tell what the document even is.
The ACLU says the two agencies cited the Confidential Criminal Justice Information Statutes in declining the records request. The ACLU also says the agencies put a gag order on the records they turned over, which prevents the ACLU from sharing the information with the public. Alvarez says Keystone XL developer, TC Energy, has announced it'll start pipeline pre-construction in February and March and construction in August.
So we are hoping to get protesters the information to them as soon as we can of what the government is doing to prepare for their protests.
The ACLU is concerned that law enforcement may take similar measures against expected Keystone XL protesters as it did during protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline in 2016 and 2017. That includes what the ACLU calls unlawful surveillance, excessive force, and criminalization of speech and assembly. Alvarez says argument in court is not always guaranteed, and the complaint will have to survive a motion to dismiss first. The Montana Division of Criminal Investigation, on behalf of itself and Montana Disaster and Emergency Services, declined to give comment. Kayla DeRoche, Yellowstone Public Radio News.
This past weekend saw record warm temperatures and gusty winds. That's a recipe for wildfire. As unusual as it sounds, YPR News' Kay Erickson reports winter wildfires are not common, but not unheard of.
Last weekend, as the groundhog Punxsutawney Phil predicted in early spring, the Belt Rural Volunteer Fire Department responded to calls for wildland fires, including a large, fast-moving one in Judith Basin County and an active timber fire near Monarch. But winter wildfires tend to be different than the typical summer fire.
They're generally a very short duration and are driven by wind events.
That's Brian Henry, a fire weather meteorologist with the National Interagency Fire Center in Boise, Idaho.
What happens in these type of situations is that you have a westerly or northwesterly wind flow. So you have air coming up over the Continental Divide and then dropping down. As it comes down slope, that air accelerates, it warms, and as those temperatures go up, the air becomes drier, the humidity levels drop, and that dries out the grasses for a short duration.
He says summer fires are much longer and happen after grasses and other fuels have dried out over late spring and summer. Henry says the good news is the warm, dry weather has left and well below average temperatures are on the way, with an Arctic front dropping down from central Canada and more typical winter weather conditions for the next couple of weeks. I'm Kay Erickson for Yellowstone Public Radio News.
The federal government's latest snowpack report for Montana is out. Mountain snowpack across the state made vast improvements last month. Montana Public Radio's Edward O'Brien reports.
Talk about a comeback. Montana's snowpack made significant gains last month. All river basins now report near to above normal levels. Forecasters didn't necessarily expect it to work out like this. 2019 ended on a particularly dry note. Snowpack in some locations, especially in northwest Montana's river basins, was approaching near record lows by November and December.
Actually, most of them west of the divide had a couple of really dry months, and that led to some deficits with regards to snowpack and our water year precipitation.
But according to Luka Zukowicz, that worrisome dry spell broke right before New Year's Eve. Zukowicz is a water supply specialist with the U.S. Ag Department's Natural Resources Conservation Service in Bozeman.
It is a completely different story than last month at this time. You know, there were some concerns that, you know, we were going to have a persistent weather pattern, which was going to be below average precipitation through the winter. We saw a major turnaround. It's snowing a lot here right now in Bozeman, and we're anticipating a good bit more. So hopefully this is good foreshadowing for this next month.
Montana's quality snowpack is especially noteworthy given the relatively mild winter. winter.
We can think of it two ways. And one of the things which I think is unique about this past month is we are seeing valley precipitation totals, which are below average for the month, while our mountain locations just got a steady stream of moisture. And, you know, we did have rain reported even in the mountains through this month as well. So it was warm. The temperatures were above average for this month. But we did see above average precipitation with that in the mountains, and we were able to continue to build on that snowpack.
Zukowicz says Montana is now about two-thirds through its snow accumulation season. The low elevation snowpack is expected to peak in mid to late March in some areas, but the high elevation snowpack should continue to gain through mid-April. The Climate Prediction Center's 8 to 14-day outlook calls for colder than normal temperatures and wetter than normal conditions in central and eastern Montana. Western Montana could see normal precip patterns. The short-term forecast, however, calls for more slop in the Missoula and Bitterroot Valleys, where upwards of 6 inches of fresh snow are possible by Friday morning. Friday afternoon's highs could hit the low 40s. Travel could get sketchy in portions of central and southwest Montana, where higher elevations will continue to get heavy snow and gusty winds. The National Weather Service has issued a winter storm warning for the Great Falls, Helena, Butte, and Bozeman areas through midday Friday. Snow that's partially melted in the lower elevations could refreeze Friday morning, creating dangerous driving conditions. The Gallatin National Forest Avalanche Center Thursday issued avalanche warnings for multiple mountain ranges. Those warnings are valid through early Friday morning. Edward O'Brien, Montana Public Radio.
We're now going to share another kind of story from voices you might not hear otherwise. I Sat Down With is a series from the University of Montana Journalism School, and it's reported, written, and produced entirely by students. Student Evan Smith recently sat down with his grandmother, who, at 16, convinced her parents to let her leave Polson, Montana, and attend the Flandreau Indian Boarding School in South Dakota. Smith brings us Monica's story of learning to be herself far from home.
This is Evan Smith. Elmo, Montana, 1967. My grandmother, Monica Kayai, who was 16 at the time, has convinced her parents to send her to Flandreau Indian School in South Dakota. Established in 1892, Flandreau was like most boarding schools at the time. But in the late 60s, Flandreau was one of the best and only schools to get an education that extended for grades 9 through 12 for Native Americans. Instead of being scared, she was ecstatic. Like many young Native Americans at the time, she knew the importance of an education, especially as the white man's world was to become everyone's world.
I feel like if I didn't go to those two places, I wouldn't have finished my education. It taught me how to be away from home, and you know, we have our little things that we had to do then, you know, little rules to live by. And when I went to Flandreau, I felt like I was going to college, you know. I was really excited to go to high school in a different state, you know, and you didn't have your mom there, mom and dad there every minute, you know. And you felt like I was growing up, you know, and started learning how to have to get up in the morning and go to school and start learning how to use your time. And then when I was in Polson, it was like, you know, I didn't have that many friends. And when I went to Flandreau Indian School, it was an opportunity. Where else was I going to meet all the Indians from the United States but at an Indian school? And if I didn't go to Flandreau, I'd know no one out there. You know, from Browning, from Fort Belknap, I knew kids from Wolf Point, from Pine Ridge, South Dakota. And everybody seemed to get along really good, you know. It's like we all belonged. We knew we all belonged, you know. And from there, I know school was, you know, really important. And I always remember when I was a first grader, I always said I'm going to grow up and be a secretary. And I went a little further, but secretaries, because they're always so busy. I noticed the secretaries, you know, busy, 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 busy. And I was like, I'm going to be a secretary. And no, I wasn't scared at all. We just went there and went to school. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we didn't do any of our culture there. We just went to church and learned the prayers and went to Bible school and learned a lot of the Catholic ways, you know. And No, they're all right. You know, everybody has to believe in something. And like my father said, he says, take what you can get from the Catholic schools and their ways. And what you don't, when you don't, things you don't want, you just leave them and go on. And I don't want to put them down or anything, you know, because at that time, you know, we needed, our family was big and food was hard to come by, you know. And when we got to Flanger, I didn't really think anything. I just lived. I never seen anybody crying that they wanted to go home, you know. We just lived and did, you know, what we had to do.
Now, nearly 52 years later, and back in Elmo, my grandmother stares out at the Flathead Lake. After all these years, it's still her favorite spot to view. However, for Flandreau, there's been a noticeable change. The school is now run by the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs and is a haven for Native youth from troubled homes and schools. You've been listening to my grandmother, Monica Kayai, and this has been Evan Smith.
That was University of Montana student Evan Smith for the UM Journalism School's I Sat Down With series. There's an ongoing debate in Butte about public health and exposure to heavy metals in the environment from historic and current mining operations. The most recent controversy flared up this week between scientists and the Environmental Protection Agency over the contents of dirty diapers. Montana Public Radio's Nora Sachs has the details.
Last year, a team of independent researchers collected samples of baby poop from 32 infants born in Butte and Columbia, South Carolina, and tested them for heavy metals. The results of the peer-reviewed study dominated local headlines, grabbing the attention of the community and government agencies. Federal officials this week called for the study to be retracted from the academic journal. Katie Haler, a chemist at Montana Tech who worked on the study, says to some extent, baby's first poop, called meconium, can reveal what a fetus was exposed to in utero. And it's free and easy to get.
A meconium's going to be passed whether you want it to be or not, and it goes into a diaper and it goes in the trash. And most people are not attached to meconium in any way, and they're more than willing to let you take it with you.
Haler says the goal of this exploratory study was to see if they could detect heavy metals in the poop and how levels in Butte, a copper mining town and Superfund site, compare to a non-industrial community across the country. And what they found was that
the metal concentrations in Butte were very different than South Carolina.
According to the researchers, concentrations of copper, zinc, and manganese were more than 1,000 times higher in Butte baby poop versus South Carolina. They published the results in the academic journal Science of the Total Environment in December, concluding those levels of metals were cause for, quote, immediate concern and, quote, a potential public health emergency. EPA officials strongly disagreed with that characterization of the findings, especially the claim about the potential public health emergency.
Now, that's something that EPA takes extremely seriously. We've only declared that once under Superfund. That was in Libby, Montana, where we actually had dead bodies, we had deaths, we had death records.
That's Charlie Partridge, a toxicologist with EPA Region 8, during a presentation to Butte Silver Bow County's Board of Health on Wednesday morning. He said EPA looks at all new information concerning health, the environment, and Superfund, and did due diligence by conducting their own review of this independent study. After screening the meconium data from Butte and comparing the pilot study to other relevant studies from the last 50 years, EPA came to the opposite conclusion, that Butte numbers are normal and that South Carolina is the real outlier.
The Butte metal concentrations of meconium appear to be exactly what you expect based on the scientific literature. The Columbia, South Carolina meconium data are uncharacteristically low.
Partridge stressed that meconium isn't the best way to gauge prenatal metal exposure because copper, manganese, and zinc are essential micronutrients that should be in poop. And there's no established baseline of what is a safe level of metals in meconium. EPA said based on their review, there is no public health emergency in Butte, and they're going to ask the academic journal to retract the study if the authors do not do it themselves. Nakia Green, EPA's local Superfund project manager, says that's necessary because
there's been a lot of fear here in Butte. And if independent researchers and others are putting out misperceptions or false information about the safety and the health of Butte citizens, then someone needs to step up and stop it.
Chemist Katie Haler again.
I can agree with them that maybe some of the language should have been tempered. I understand their frustration with the use of potential public health emergency. Maybe the discussion surrounding the study would be completely different if things had been worded a little bit differently from the beginning.
However, because their study was so limited in scope, she says there's not enough evidence to know why there was such a big difference in the amount of metals found in baby poop between Butte and South Carolina. And she believes that question warrants further research.
I don't think that we should attack scientific data because we don't like the data that came from that scientific study. And I feel like that's what has happened here.
Haler said the study authors, which include Suzanne McDermott, an epidemiologist, and Jamie Lead, a chemist, both in South Carolina, have no intention of retracting their meconium study and are seeking funding to conduct a more comprehensive investigation. After the meeting on Wednesday, I asked Seth Cornell, a local physician and Board of Health member, if he still had concerns about the meconium study. He said he agrees with EPA that there's probably not a health emergency, but we have to be data-driven.
The data to me says that there's ongoing exposure. Whether or not the exposure translates to health outcomes, that's a whole nother difficult question, and there haven't been any strong studies to tie exposure to health outcomes. So I think there's going to be work to be done from here till eternity. And unless the population of Butte picks up and moves off the Superfund site, we're going to have to be looking at these things.
Butte's health department is forming a new advisory committee to discuss and analyze any new research or studies concerning the health of Mining City residents. I'm Nora Sachs, Montana Public Radio.
And that's what's happening in Montana today. Check in with Montana Public Radio's Montana Evening News for updates on news of the day. I'm Nikki Ouellette, filling in for Jess Sheldahl. Thanks for listening, and happy Friday.
The Worm is produced by Jess Sheldahl for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Meadowlark Call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. Partial funding for The Worm is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.